Welcome to Design Oracles. We are here to pontificate, evangelize, and educate you on residential interior design and architecture.
I'm Amity Worrell, interior designer of Amity Worrell & Company.
And I'm Diane Kett, architect of DK Studio, and together partners at Amity Kett.
Hello, welcome to our final show of our season.
Yep, we're going to talk about each of our top five things that have kind of related to all these patterns.
Mm-hmm. Pattern language and behavior studies.
Yeah, that are some of our big things about behavior studies and the impact in design.
Yeah, and so what we were thinking is we would share with you kind of our favorite and most common struggles, interests, and patterns or things that come up with clients that are kind of really good tips and ways to think about spaces. Diane's are a little more positive than mine, so she's thinking more about what are her favorites, and mine are a little bit more about what drives me crazy.
Anyway, it's all good.
It's all good. It's all helpful.
Yeah. All right. Who's going first? You or me? We can trade off.
Let's go back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So why don't you start?
Okay. So mine first one is what I call the dump zone.
Yay.
And a lot of times when I bring that up, people say the dump zone and they turn their head and have a quizzical look. And I say, you know, where you come in and you drop all your stuff and you dump it somewhere. And so we try to create a space that helps collect that. So a lot of times we make that in the mudroom usually, and it's a space where you can dump before you walk into your house. So you're dumping your purse, your backpack, your iPad,
your
sports stuff, your shoes, your jackets, your mail, your keys. You've got a dump zone for all that to happen.
Yeah, and what the dump zone does for you is keep the rest of your house feeling clean and tidy.
Yes.
And organized. And it also, I think of it as a holding place, right? So I come in with 15 things. It's even some dishes from my car because I maybe ate breakfast on the way to work. Or I put them down. I go in. I try to relax a little bit, whatever it is. Pour myself a glass of wine, whatever it is. Figure out what I'm about to deal with for the evening with my kids and my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe I go back to my dump zone, to my, for me, it's a laundry room, mudroom space. That's right off my garage. And I put the dishes in, you know, in the sink, or have the kids empty their backpack. I kick my shoes under the space that I have provided for that. And it's just nice to not have that clutter all over my house. So it's a place where I put everything and then I can move on with the day and then always have it there and come back and have it handy too when it's time to go back out the door.
Yeah, and it's a spot where you're constantly picking up and moving things, so you're not really worried so much about it collecting dust because it's constantly moving.
Yeah, and I think maybe too having it separate a little bit from the public view is nice. That gives you peace of mind. So I agree with Diane on that one. It's one of my favorite aspects to add to a space when there isn't one and we have to try to create it with furniture or something. It's something everybody really
needs.
And
it does. It brings a lot of happiness to people.
It does.
They always love it. And we always love to take pictures of it too because it's always a nice,
fun moment. People love their stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Is it my turn?
Yeah.
Okay. Island seating.
Ooh, yeah.
Okay. So let me be clear. It's not that I am opposed to all island seating, but I'm talking about kitchen islands here, not Hawaiian islands. So island seating. Here's my TED Talk. So I think based on behavioral studies that I have made over 25 years of doing this, those islands that have the seating lined up maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 in a row, facing away from the view, away from the room where most of the activity in an open plan space anyway would be, is unrealistic to me. I don't see people using it. It looks really good in photos. I get it. The chairs, the islands are beautiful. The islands themselves are very useful, but the chairs at the island are beautiful. It looks very engaging, but in reality, it is not engaging because no one sits thigh to thigh as a family facing away from one another. People naturally like to sit facing one another so that they can engage. Oftentimes, it's only two people at a time that are sitting at those spaces. They're very, very comfortable and great for breakfast, for hanging out while someone's cooking. But again, I don't see 5, 6, 7 people all sitting in a row, thigh to thigh, watching someone make food. What ends up happening, and this is my favorite thing to say, it's true, it's just it ends up being, if you don't have a dump zone in particular, a place where your bag ends up. It's where your purse sits, it's where your keys go, it's where your Target bag goes, it's where your groceries fall. And I just like to have a conversation with people about maybe limiting the number of island seating that they have or turning it. Diane and I both like that, to have kind of a corner, the seating kind of wrapping a corner, three, maybe four at the most spots, but maybe two on one side and two on the other. Or I love just the three, because then that gives you one space where it's okay. Yes, you can put your bag or your things down, and then two for people to sit. But just something to think about, because it seems to be a knee-jerk reaction for people that they want that island seating. Oftentimes, instead of taking advantage of that in a space, especially when they've already got a breakfast area and a dining table within 10 feet of each other. So it's, you know, there's not that many people. There's not 12 or 15 people living in the house. We only need to seat 4 to 6. Maybe that under counter space gets used for more storage, or bigger and more appliances, a beverage fridge, or cookbooks or something like that. So that's just a conversation that I like to have with people about. Just think about, where do you want to face in the morning if you come in and have your coffee, or you want to sit and face the view and look out? If you're going to sit down and have your dinner there while the kids are doing their homework, where do you want to face? So sort of thinking about that, not just plunking it down with its back to the view. So thanks for listening to my TED Talk.
Although sometimes the lining up of a few chairs is also good. I've seen like moms, they're kind of just like you said, the breakfast or the lunch, and they're just putting out the plates and everyone walks up and eats. But what I would say is they're not sitting there to have conversations with each other. Yeah. They're just there to eat, right?
It's just there to eat. And then I also think younger kids don't sit for very long. At least my experience is like the littles are just up and down, and then it's awkward to climb up and down off a bar stool. So
yeah,
just something to consider.
Right. What about when you drop down the island?
Yeah.
Oh, you have a piece of it, so it's more like a table?
Yeah, I love that. Mm-hmm. Thank you for mentioning that. I love that. When you have attached seating on your island, but you've dropped it down from that sort of standard countertop height, which is 36 to maybe 30 or 29 or 30, which is dining height. It's the same height your dining or breakfast table would be. That tends to be very comfortable, and people will hang out there and have conversations, as Diane says. You know, they'll sit more comfortably and for longer, and little children and older people sit more comfortably in those, and they can get up and down more easily. And it just tends to be a place people will really gather more. So, yeah, particularly if you have a limited amount of space for kitchen eating, maybe consider that.
Yeah, it's a great if you don't design have a breakfast feature.
Area, it's a good design feature. So we've done islands where at the end there'll be a lower table and you can seat the entire family there, and it can feel more formal or more casual. And so, yeah, that's one of my favorites. Okay, your turn.
Okay, another one is the use of natural light in a space. And I know we did, I kind of waxed poetic about the windows on two sides, which hopefully you all have started to notice since listening to that podcast. But just the great quality of natural light in a space is just so important to your happiness of being in that space. I don't know. And just it just connects you so much better to nature and probably the scale of the room and just an overall good feeling.
Yeah, light is so important. Light is so important for comfort and happiness in a space. I agree. So I'll do my light.
So I always have lots of windows in all my houses.
Yes, usually. You do. And they're big. And I have to cover them. Okay, so I'll do my lighting one since Diane's talking about lighting.
Did mine was natural you? Lighting. Yours,
mine will be
artificial lighting.
Mm-hmm. Right? So pet peeve, again, starting with that. Pet peeve is generally, here's my TED Talk on can lights, recessed hi-hats, they call them in the East Coast. I don't remember the other names for them, but recessed can lights, which can be round, can be square, can be different sizes, are a great way, don't get me wrong, to get light in a room if you need to clean it or look for your contact lens.
Or cook.
Yes. Good for kitchens. Mm-hmm. So yes, Diane and I always have this debate. I love them in kitchens. I love them in mudrooms and laundry rooms.
Right.
And I love them in bathrooms.
Where you need to see to do tasks.
Where you really need to see. Where I particularly am not a fan is in living spaces, living rooms, formal dining rooms, because you don't need to see as well or in the same way. And in bedrooms.
Yeah, that's my pet peeve. I really don't like them in bedrooms.
I don't know why they're there. So
it's like eyeballs looking at you mm-hmm. when you lay in bed.
And I think part of it is for me is my eye goes to ceilings a lot, and I like very clean ceilings. Mm-hmm. So I don't like a lot of sort of pockmarks in the ceiling and like holes and fuss in the ceiling. If I want something to look at in the ceiling, I want it to be pretty. So my preference is for ambient light down low. Wall sconces is a great way to light a room very effectively. And task lights such as reading lamps, floor lamps, sometimes table lamps. Just something to consider. Picture lights on the walls.
Oh, yeah.
Beautifully lighting the art or the bookcase. All I'll say is there's just a world of wonderful lighting out there, and can lights seem like the laziest choice to me mm-hmm. and not as thoughtful for living and bedroom spaces. They're absolutely essential for kitchens and for laundry rooms and for bathrooms to mm-hmm. me, but I do like the smaller ones as well. And it's interesting, over the years, can lights – the ability to light a room has been impacted by LED lighting changing. And
right.
So, right, like the 2-inch cans or the 4-inch give off as much light, if not more, the new ones, as the 6-inch round cans used to give off. So that's one of my favorite things to talk about. And I'll say one more thing about it in historic properties especially.
Oh,
I still think they're needed in kitchens, of course. But you want to think carefully about anything you do to a ceiling in a home that maybe has a lot of integrity related to a period in history where that wasn't a thing. Even mid-century homes, can lights tend to be incongruous. So
yeah, they'd have that – like in the kitchen, they'd have that big – they would build like this big artificial box light and usually have fluorescent bulbs in it, right? But
yeah.
Then it would have that translucent –
so clearly cans are better than that.
Yeah. But the point was they were trying to figure out a way that had minimal impact to create a lot of light.
Yeah. Yeah. So it worked for the time. But then in those mid-century living rooms, you're not going to see can lights. That is not – you would see sconces perhaps and floor lamps. And so they're not the villains.
Or a nice hanging fixture.
Or a lovely pendant. Yeah. Hanging mm-hmm. fixture or a chandelier. So
the next thing I would say is proportion, which has to do with the inside of your spaces, the exterior facade, the change in ceiling heights. Just proportion is such a key in good design and good design of a space and how it feels and how you're experiencing it and how you're behaving in it. And I just feel like the proportion of space is just fundamental. And I always tell my clients that it doesn't matter what style you want. As long as the proportion is good, it'll be great.
I love that. That's so true. So do you find that hard for people to wrap their head around and trust and understand?
Yes.
That's what I would think. That wasn't
so
a setup.
So I say it defiantly.
Yeah. That's what I would think. I do think that just in my engaging with you and talking with clients and hearing you talk about those early stages of design with homes and they're maybe they've seen an image of something that they think they want and you sort of trying to explain that to them, that they need to trust that you have their best interest at heart with how they're going to feel in that space based on those proportions. And mm-hmm. it's a hard thing. People say bigger, 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 or smaller, smaller, smaller. Mm-hmm. And then we have to push back and say, no, we there's a relationship to size of furniture, size of people, size yeah. of passages. Luckily, there's codes we can fall back onto that help us. But yeah, that's really, really important furniture mm-hmm. too. Let's see. I'm going to go with, since we just mentioned furniture, furniture plans that alienate are a big struggle for people. So this is the phone call. Hi, you know, I need some help, but my space is not working and I don't know why. I've bought all this lovely furniture. It's just not working. I have people over and nobody sits in the living room. They all stand at the island and nobody even sits at the island. They stand at the island and they mill around against the corners of the rooms, as we were talking earlier. They'll stand against the walls or against the corners. And in another podcast we were talking about. So sometimes it's just the furniture plan, just the way the room is laid out. You know, one thing that comes up a lot for people is they've spent a lot of money on a big, beautiful sectional, and they've placed it close to the television, facing the television with its back to the kitchen. An open plan space is what I'm referring to at this point. And nobody ever sits in it. Maybe they sit at it at night for 2 hours to watch Netflix before they go to sleep. But they have people over and they've bought this big sectional and they imagine engaging with their friends around it and nobody ever sits in it. And part of it's because everybody wants to be to feel like they can get up and down from their seating at a party easily or a gathering easily. And they're very committal when you say like a sectional is a commitment.
It is.
Yeah. It's more of a family seating arrangement for people who really, really like each other and want to touch and be close and cuddle up.
Yeah.
And even if you've got a large one, it's, you know, so I'm short myself. If I try to sit back and get really comfortable, then I don't feel like I can get up and grab another drink or reach the hors d'oeuvres. So I always like to tell people, you know, sectionals are wonderful, well and good for family rooms and families, media rooms, off of master bedrooms, in a master bedroom even, like as an additional space. Mm-hmm. They don't tend to work great for entertaining and large groups.
Because kind of like the island, you don't want to sit thigh to thigh all up against each other.
With Aunt Millie.
So let's say your only seating option in your living room is that sectional. And maybe there might be a chair, right?
There's probably one chair.
Everyone goes to the chair first. Mm-hmm. Just watch. Everyone goes to the chair first.
My favorite is they perch on the back of the sectional.
Yeah.
And they never sit down and they're never comfortable. And there's nowhere. There's just this vast, empty space.
And if you have seven people, do they all sit up, all lined up?
Exactly.
Going around the sectional? When have you ever seen that?
Never.
When?
You
when?
Never have. And if you insist on having a sectional, at least let me point it towards the view instead of just the television with its back to the engagement. So a lot of times we'll actually take the sectionals and break them up. We'll take them to the upholstery workroom, cut this sucker in half. Or break it into two, reupholster, put it back together. Because there's people spend a lot of money on those. So I don't, you know, that. And then along those lines, just generally alienating furniture plans that don't have enough seating. So, for instance, one thing I'll run into is, you know, a family of six with one sofa in maybe a 4,000 square foot house, one sofa in their living room. And it boggles the mind as to where we think we're going to be comfortable in a house with six people with one sofa that seats three comfortably, really, if you want like arm room and space and place for the popcorn and all of that. So don't be afraid of extra sofas. I lived in 1,500 square feet and I had, I think, three or four at one point, and they all fit comfortably in the space. And my family each got an upholstered sofa for themselves. So, and it all worked. So don't be afraid of that. You want to think about your furniture plan, think about facing the view, think about not being alienating, and don't commit yourself to a big expensive sectional if your goal is to entertain lots of different types of groups of people that don't want to all cuddle up together in one space.
Yeah. And I think upholstered chairs are massively important. Everyone
Absolutely.
Always goes to those.
Yeah. And swivel chairs mm-hmm. that turn and swivel in both directions. Mm-hmm. They provide you the opportunity to kind of follow your host around the room. Like if you're sitting with a glass of wine mm-hmm. and the host is moved to the kitchen and you can turn your chair to look that direction or maybe look outside if you're sitting alone and reading. So just something to think about.
And then kind of a good rule of thumb that I learned early on in design was this other design professional had said, well, however many people you have planned to seat at the dining room table, you need to have that many seat comfortably in the living room, which I thought was
that's a great
just
one.
A fabulous stroke of genius, right?
I love Isn't that. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way. Yeah, for me, I always say I want to be able to find a way to seat 12 adults comfortably in mm-hmm. a space. And so whether that's – so that takes a good bit of upholstered furniture. But and people also think that their space, their furniture needs to be closer together than it actually needs to be. You can spread out a little mm-hmm. bit. And then that gives you an opportunity to add more upholstered chairs or a whole nother sofa or really claim that space for sitting.
You'll and there's happier. Different sizes of chairs Absolutely. And sofas that mm-hmm. you can get. They don't have to be the big giant ones.
Yep. Yep. I think a lot of that's related to what you were talking about earlier with room sizes and scale. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I will say that's really hard for people. It is very common that people get scale wrong. And it's not always their fault. They go to these big box stores to buy their furniture. Mm-hmm. There's no ceiling at all, practically. You look up and it may as well be heaven. And you have no idea of how large your piece of furniture is. And you get it home to your 1,300 square foot house or whatever it is, and sometimes literally can't get it through the door, or it just dominates the room in a way that mm-hmm. makes everything else feel smaller. So that's a common thing that's difficult, I think.
And didn't you say some people think when you put too much furniture in that then it's too hard to move around?
Oh, yeah. So Diane knows that this is one of my favorite. I've had people, move into a space. I always try to tell people, if you're moving into a space that is new to you, please do not place your furniture until I come by and tell you where it should go. Because people get set in their ways very quickly. And I've had people tell me their sofa is in a spot maybe, or their table is in a location. There's a sofa table and they've lived with it that way for a couple weeks maybe, or maybe longer. And then I'll say, well, this needs to move. We're going to pivot this and move it. I'll trip. I'm going to bump into it. Why will you bump into it if I move it? Did you bump into it when you first put it in the room? Mm-hmm. So it's just a weird – sorry, I sound really critical, but it drives me crazy. It's a weird conceptual thing, it's something true about it that people get very quickly very used to passages through rooms mm-hmm. in a certain way. And so I try to say, have an open mind. Let's move the furniture and live with it for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You can adapt. If I put a wall here, you're not going to walk into the wall.
Right.
Just, so it's just about patterns mm-hmm. and it's about your movement through space and your furniture will change that, the location mm-hmm. of your furniture. And so, yeah, lots to say on that.
And sometime. I will say that Amity is a fantastic furniture planner, designer, layout, I don't know, yeah. all of the above. So I kind of do quick plans as I'm laying them out just to make sure things fit. But then I give it to Amity and she always comes up with these fabulous designs. So
yeah, and it's about getting butts in seats, I always say. Butts in seats, comfort. So yeah. All right, your turn.
Okay, so another one of mine is the foyer. It really is important. I know sometimes we just don't have enough space and we can't necessarily get a foyer, but I really try to always get some type of foyer in. It's just from the front door. It just helps give you that pause, that moment before you go into the house, the separateness of the public and private space mm-hmm. and just making this nice, inviting moment by your front door, whether it's big, agree. Small or grand. It just is a really important thing in a house, I think.
It's interesting, too, because early on when Diane and I started working together, I began to very quickly identify her signatures, and they were foyer. Comfortably sized hallways. Oh my goodness, thank you. And I know you don't like hallways, but when they're there, they feel like little rooms that you can actually do something with that are beautiful and comfortable and easy to move through, and light. Mm-hmm. You do masterful light locations for windows and natural light. So, and actually, just another little aside, I had this conversation with a landscape architect that I'm working with, And she actually said the exact same thing about Light and Diane's plans.
Oh,
did you know that
nice.
Alexis
no,
said that?
Nice.
Yeah. So that is very true. And so I quickly identified that you had an understanding for. There's just a feeling you get when you've arrived somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's a sense of arrival. And if you don't get that, it's very it can be very disjointing.
It's like, disconcerting.
Mm-hmm. It is. Mm-hmm. You don't, am I in or am I out? And then it is different when you say to the mudroom drop zone experience, because mm-hmm. it's more for guests or.
Yeah, it's not where you're dumping all your stuff. It's just this nice pause moment where, and like if it's a salesman or mm-hmm. somebody, you know, that you don't really want to see in your house or come in, or it's, you know.
It's the handshake or the hug moment. It's, you know, saying goodbye.
Or the no thank you moment.
Or the no thank you. Slam the door.
Not today.
Yeah. Okay, is it my turn?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is my last one. Awkward banquette seating. Again, there's a theme here. You can see that.
Mm-hmm. Banquettes are so hard to get, right? And everyone loves them. And if you don't get it right, you've spent all this money and there's no point sitting there. Right?
I've ripped so many of those suckers out. And so I'm giving away all my tips here. But let me tell you, do not build one of those boxy to the floor. Pretend like you're going to use the storage underneath banquettes built into a window wall that is not comfortable and doesn't have a back on it. You can't tuck your legs underneath. The proportions aren't right. People slap them in. They look great in magazines, but they're not comfortable. And they're beautiful and amazing when they're designed right, but it takes thoughtfulness. You've got to have a comfortable lean on the back, a pitch on the back. You've got to have the right number of cushions and pillows. Not that it has to be plush or sleek. It can also just be a slab of wood, but it needs to have angles. In general, when I design furniture, seating is the most difficult thing to design. It is very difficult because it's such a complicated physical experience to sit and to have that be right. So we study the way people sit. We study furniture that's successful, and we use those proportions and that knowledge to design a banquette so that it acts like a comfortable chair. And that is where people go wrong. They think of it as a built-in. It is built-in. They think of it as a case good, a place where they're going to store their, I don't know, do people have CDs anymore? Where they're going to store their cookery or something.
Placemats.
Or it's not storage. If you're going to sit on it, it's furniture. So that's just something that I think makes me crazy. And I'll say one of the other things is it needs to have some curves and it and some softness, because you don't want to bang your leg every time you get in and out. It needs to be paired with the right type of table, particularly a pedestal, so you won't bang your leg when you get in and out. And it needs to be small enough that 2 to 3 people can get in and out comfortably. Don't expect, again, 7 people to sit thigh to thigh in a banquette for 5 hours. They're going to pop in and then immediately want to get back out. We've all been to Denny's and you get scooted in that big seating area. Mm-hmm. And all you can think is, oh, dang it, now I have to go to the bathroom. And you just, all you want is to get out and you feel trapped. It's the same thing happens in your kitchen. So just be realistic about the proportions. Think of it as
furniture. It is a great spot if you have a bunch of kids, because they can all squish together. But they're usually, like you said, they're sitting, they're up, and they're out.
The thing
about them, and they're gone.
Them is they're agile. So they just climb. If they need to get up,
they can crawl under the table.
Like, go potty, and they're out. So anyway, just something to think about. Think of it as furniture. It's a built-in furniture, not a storage piece. So.
Well, my last one, and I guess we'll end on this, is a connection to the outdoors. We talked a lot about the outdoor room and the Zen view and just kind of your soul connection to the earth. Just having some connection from your house to the outdoors, whether it's a balcony, it's a little courtyard space, if it's something that you're creating, or if you are capturing some amazing view. Or if you're just looking at a tree line through your clerestory windows. But it's just having that connection, I think, is really important in your house. And it just also is what also contributes to making it feel really good. So
yeah, and if you think about how important it is, I mean, the opposite of that is like a prison design. Mm-hmm. That disconnection to nature, that not having that view, it's mental torture. You really want connection to the outside. You really want to have a sense of where you are in space and time. You want to know, you know, is it raining?
Mm-hmm.
What is it windy? What's going on? You know, I know a lot of mid-century houses, and I live in one, don't have a lot of great connection to the outside. It wasn't a thing. Maybe in the bedrooms as much, and they've been added. They can, of course, but a lot of the sort of like track homes that I live in, mm-hmm. basically updated, engaging track home, let's be clear, has been renovated. But, you know, it takes some thoughtfulness to, if you're going to renovate those, to make sure that they have that connection. And, you know, there's something to be said for interior spaces too, but if they don't have that balance and that connection, you just feel disjointed. And, you know, I hate to have to, you know, have to go search around my house to try to figure out what's going on outside. You know, just having that little, and I love the little step out of the master bedroom space to have a cup of coffee and check the weather and pet the dog, that kind
of
thing.
Yes, right. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's just so important.
Yeah.
We just all need it.
We do. It's good for mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening.
Yeah,
we appreciate you.
We'll be working on our season 3 next. So hope you enjoyed listening to this season on behavior studies and impact in design. And maybe I'll pick up a copy of Pattern Language to read.
And we'll see you next season.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Design Oracles with Amity Worrell, owner of Amity Worrell & Company, and Diane Kett, owner of DK Studio, and together, partners at Amity Kett.